Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's a real pleasure for me to introduce the speaker tonight, Don Kennedy. We've known each other since 1960 when we were both young faculty members at Stanford University. Don, that's 48 years ago, if you compute that. It's a long time. Over the years, our careers have entangled in many different ways. We've had close associations, both professionally and personally and family-wise. Don's research career has been in the field of neurobiology, and some of his early pioneering research on neural networks, the structure and function of neural networks, was extremely important. And his work, along with a few other people, helped lay the foundations for what's come to be called the neurosciences. And I think Don can claim with good reason that he was one of the founders of an era of modern research that is extremely exciting and promising. He has been widely recognized for his scientific contributions, elected at a very early age to the National Academy of Sciences, a mentor to a long stream of graduate students and postdoctorals who fill laboratories around the country. But in addition to having a distinguished scientific career, he also was, and I use a term here that you may be shocked at, he was a terrific teacher as an undergraduate teacher at Stanford. Are there any alumni here from Stanford who took courses from him? You took well, I'm sure you're here to get the sense of what it was like as a student at Stanford to be in a course that Don taught. He was loved by students. He was a marvelous teacher and had a tremendous impact on many, many generations of students who flowed through Stanford. Don has been associated with Stanford throughout his career, but in 1977, he took a leave of absence from Stanford and was appointed as the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. And I think to many people, his choice as the commissioner of the FDA was somewhat of a surprise. Many people felt, why would a biologist with interests in laboratory research be heading an agency which was focused on food and drug issues, where an individual who'd had no real background in the food or drug industry? So it was an unusual choice. And almost from the immediate start, he was confronted with a whole array of problems, very difficult problems. But in retrospect, his selection turned out to be the perfect appointment for FDA at that time. The FDA was at a turning point in its history, and Don helped make that turn, focusing the importance of science and a systematic approach to regulatory policy in the framework of this FDA. Don was only there for 3 years, but I think it's fair to say that he has been recognized as one of the individuals who transformed the fundamental nature of the Food and Drug Administration and really brought good science and good policy to bear on the issues of regulation. He was brought back to Stanford as its provost in 1979, and then was elected as president a year later. From 1980 to 1992, he was president of Stanford University, and to say the least, those were fabulous years for the university. Now, I hope the Stanford people in the audience won't be offended by this next remark, but Stanford, before World War II, was a fine regional university, but it was not a great national university. But after World War II, a series of events occurred that moved it on a very steep trajectory to being a truly great university. And I think it's fair to say that during Don's tenure of 12 years, Stanford arrived at that position of being one of the two or three greatest research universities in the nation. And so Don has been involved with that evolution of Stanford from its early days to the greatness that describes it today. Don also mounted a huge fundraising effort during that period, the largest capital campaign in the history of higher education. And as you might expect, given his interest in undergraduate work, did much to focus on the undergraduate curriculum. He stepped down in 1992 to become the Bing Professor of Environmental Science. I won't comment on his interests on these matters. He'll be talking about that tonight. But I can remember back to the early 60s when he was very focused on environmental issues. And at the time, one could almost see the trajectory of his interests in that area. Finally, I want to take note of the fact that he served, just stepped down after serving for 8 years as the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. This is a weekly international journal published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Extremely important journal, both for science policy issues and for science itself. But when Don arrived, like so many points in his career, it was at a transition. I won't go into all the issues associated with the journal at that time, but just think in terms of the move from a pre-internet period to an internet period, and Don carried through that transition in a wonderful way. Let me just conclude. I might call him a senior statesman, but I don't think he'd like that, and I can't look at Don or listen. Oh, by the way, I meant to add, Don also, as editor of the of Science, was an often contributor to the editorial page, quite frequent contributor. And he wrote some very tough and interesting editorials, and there was never any question that they were written by Don Kennedy, because I could always hear, when I read those editorials, I could literally hear his voice in the background as I read through the editorials. But they were editorials that made a difference and had a real impact on science issues in Washington and elsewhere. So I conclude by saying he's an individual who has had a fundamental background in research and science. He's had a brilliant record on policy issues, and he's had a great instinct for being in the right institution at the right time and doing the right thing. Don, the podium is yours.
Thank you very much. Dick and I had a deal. No ties, but no jacket. I hope you'll all make yourselves as comfortable as you can. I want to thank Dick for, first of all, a kind introduction that was more generous than I deserve, and second, for making sure that when I got to visit UCSD, I could do it when I could see him again, and he helped bring that off, and I'm deeply grateful for it. He did not, by the way, lie about the length of time we have known one another. I sometimes wish he wouldn't say those things, but he did, and it's right. So here's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to tell a sort of three-part story, and I have to tell you how I arrived at the three parts. A year ago, I was asked to give the Clark Kerr lectures at the University of California, and I thought, what could I say about the passages that have engaged the relationship between government and government-sponsored research and the great research universities of this country? And I decided that there are really three parts. The first part is the famous letter from Vannevar Bush to President Roosevelt, but it was delivered to Truman, about the endless frontier and the opportunities for university and government science. The second is what is commonly known as the Bayh-Dole Act, an act by the Congress in 1980, which created a new environment for the relationship between commerce and research by disclaiming government ownership of the intellectual property resulting from research that it had sponsored. That's an important step, and we'll have more to say about that. Finally, I'm going to spend most of my time, really, on, but don't be scared, on the relationship between universities and university research and public regard for science and the scientists who do it. So that's the plan, and I have to ask only one piece of forgiveness in advance, and that is that some of the episodes I will refer to a personal acquaintance with some of the people or some of the events. That's the only way I can remember them. But please remember, A, that I don't mean to sound self-important, because I don't feel that way. And second, because you should all remember that memory is not history. So let's start with Vannevar Bush, which I began to pursue not only with conversations with Dick, who knows a lot about this, probably more than I, but with the excellent biography written by Pascal Zachary, a really superb work. Here's the story. First of all, what Bush wanted was a unified government support mechanism for science, a singular presence that would produce science that was important to industry for product development and for other purposes. He chose a stunning metaphor, the endless frontier. It's a real estate metaphor. Why in the world would he have done that? Why would he have likened the unexplored parts of the American West to the unexplored domains of scientific understanding? That's a useful metaphor, and I think we'll see in a moment how it came to be used and thought about later. Well, he wanted that, but he didn't get all of it. He got something that was originally called the National Research Foundation. It later evolved into something that Dick Atkinson once led for the nation, the National Science Foundation. But there were a lot of pieces that didn't get in the National Science Foundation, although Bush urgently wished that they would. One of them, for example, was medicine. The Congress, the aging Congress, had an affection with the health-directed institutes of the National Institutes of Health that afforded them useful protection against the ambition to put medicine, defense, research, and education all together in the same unit. Well, those were the things he hoped to get, but the things he got weren't quite complete. First of all, what the Congress retained for medicine. Second of all, was that some of the defense establishments like DOD and the Energy Department decided to create their own silos to support university research. Sid Galler at the Office of Naval Research and others found a way to start programs with universities that essentially undercut the desire of Bush to coagulate them or combine them in a single institution. Nevertheless, what he succeeded in doing was enormously valuable to the course of research in the United States. It put American science in a position that was unduplicated elsewhere in the world because it was decided to do it in a way that wasn't done anywhere else. It was put in the universities. It supported them enormously. And all I can say about the success of the enterprise is that I'm really glad that Vannevar Bush did not live to watch the process that started in the late 1960s, by which government support of university research began to plateau, to slow down, and eventually to presage the near death of discretionary spending in the American government. I want to say one more kind of anecdote about that. In 1968, I was chairman of the biology department at Stanford, and we had a site visit from a team that was evaluating us for an improvement of the basement of Heron Laboratories, which was then the biology research laboratories. What happened was that we gathered in a conference room on a Saturday afternoon, and there were loud noises coming across the campus from Stanford Stadium. And somebody brought me the word that there was a very exciting young quarterback at Stanford named Jim Plunkett who was doing amazing things. Well, all I can say is Heron Hall is not in very good shape now, and neither are Plunkett's knees. These things have a way of changing before your eyes. So the Bush plan was magnificent. It set up a magnificent enterprise. Support has continued to be erratic, though plateaued. The post-Sputnik burst in increased funding soon leveled off. And that's the universe in which we've been living. One point. One thing Bush never mentioned in the letter or any place else in the Endless Frontier memo is that it is intellectual property. There was no mention that anyone would own ideas, research results, or data. So what then happened? Well, it was hard to tell exactly what was happening. Dick Atkinson was head of the National Science Foundation in the late 1970s when I was marooned at FDA in beautiful Rockville, Maryland. There were interesting things happening that Dick knew about, but I'm sure, but I didn't. And that is that there were congressional committees that were getting interested in the fact that there weren't a lot of patents coming out of all the money that was being spent on university-supported research. Wasn't that a shame? Meanwhile, some clever university people began to recognize that there might be change in the winds, and a smart engineer-turned-lawyer named Niels Riemers was going up to Washington while I wasn't noticing and testifying before congressional committees. What was he testifying for? Well, he was hoping that there would be a waiver from the rule that you had to get permission from the government to actually develop a finding that had been made with the support of government research to get a waiver. And in fact, Riemers had obtained a waiver that was particular to Stanford as early as 1979. That waiver came about because Stanford and the University of California wanted very much to realize the revenue on the patents for recombinant DNA synthesis, the Cohen-Boyer patents, the famous patents that were dreamed up in a delicatessen in Honolulu. I've always heard this, but I don't think there are delicatessens in Honolulu. Not real ones anyway. But that's the lore. So what was going on? Well, the first thing that happened was that in the tax law revisions in the late 70s, Congress had passed some changes in capital gains that definitely favored venture capital and loosened up some pockets in various places, not excluding Silicon Valley, where I live. The Stanford waiver had come through, but the Congress was beginning seriously to consider executing that permission more generally. And that's what they wound up doing. They passed in 1980 the so-called Bayh-Dole amendments, which essentially forswore government claims on research done in universities, even though that research was being done with considerable funding by the United States government. And so I find myself in an interesting position. The waiver had been granted by the time I got to Stanford. I was provost for the last part of 79. And Stanley Cohen, one of the co-inventors of recombinant DNA, came to my office. And the purpose was that we would negotiate the distribution of Stanford's share of the royalties on the patent that was jointly issued to Stanford and UC. Stanford was left free to do those negotiations, and I think it did them reasonably well. But then Congress passed the Bayh-Dole Act, and so all of a sudden, the combination of venture capital money, professorial interest in carrying their work in the laboratory into the development of products, the prospect of sharing income from those companies as well as royalties on the licenses, if the university was prepared to grant them, produced a real explosion. All of a sudden, there were startups occupying the penumbra of universities with faculty members, with some kinds of advisory roles, and so forth. And the system grew like Topsy. It was an interesting challenge for university administrators because all of a sudden you had to figure out what the correct structure of relationships between these new startups and the university was. Were we landlords and they tenants? Could they give us money as long as we did what they wanted? Not likely. What would we do if it turned out that a faculty member was doing the same work in his laboratory and his graduate students were being urged to work in his company as well? We had to solve a range of those problems. The research committee at Stanford, the faculty committee, was assigned that task. They said no to some things. They said yes to others. There were conferences among university leaders and industry people about what the rules ought to be. Derek Bach at Harvard found his picture on the front page of the New York Times when his daughter brought the paper in and said, "Dad, what's your picture doing on the cover of the New York Times?" And he said, "Well, if I read this correctly, it's about whether whether Harvard would co-invest with a faculty member who was starting one of these companies." Well, Derek said, "No, we're not going to do that." And so did most universities. But there were other relationships that were a little more difficult to titrate in terms of their propriety. So that was an interesting time, and of course the government had some problems with it too, because the new recombinant DNA technology might have to be regulated, and there was an interagency committee that finally reached a judgment that it should be regulated at NIH through the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, and that seemed to settle public concerns about killer microbes and other possible outcomes of that research if it was to be allowed to go forward freely. I want to create a digression here for a minute to talk about what I think is a useful analogy, but you may not like it. Here's the Bayh-Dole Act. Think about it in terms of the endless frontier. The endless frontier is an intellectual space, likened in the metaphor used by Bush, to that real space. Where can we find some indication that that kind of problem generated in real space matches up with the problem that Bayh-Dole generated in intellectual space? And I think there's a good argument to be made that the Homestead Act of 1862, in fact, was the equivalent in real space of the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980. Both of them enclosed a space, real space in terms of the Homestead Act, intellectual space in terms of Bayh-Dole. It allocated as private property pieces of a space that had otherwise been publicly owned. What lessons can be drawn from the Homestead Act? It turned out that the Homestead Act, which gave 160 acres to homesteaders who would be willing to manage the land and protect it and improve it, worked fine east of the 10 inches or 15 inches of rain area in the tall grass prairie. It worked okay in the midgrass prairie. Once it hit the basin and range and the mountains, it was really problematic because some of the terrain was too vertical to mine or too vertical to farm, and other spaces in the basin and range were way too dry to grow anything. So what we wound up with was a mixture of private lands and public lands. And how well do they get along? Well, ask the Ask the rancher who shoots the wolf that escapes from the national park. Talk to the wise use movement about government-owned land. It's a difficult assortment of spaces, intellectual in the one case, real estate in the other, that is created when you mix private and public enterprises together without a set of careful understandings or rules about how the mix works. I don't have any evidence that the conversions created by the Bayh-Dole amendments create the same kinds of problems that the sodbusters and the cowboys had that are reprised in constantly in Western movies. But still, there are real problems. One of my frequent colleagues has described what she believes is an anti-commons that has developed in the case of scientific communication, that because there's money involved as well as competition for prestige, there is now a lot more hiding of data from other people. In other words, that the scientific commons envisioned by the endless frontier is having trouble. I think that remains to be sorted out, just as it remains to be sorted out in the case of the real estate anti-commons, if there is one, of the ends of the Homestead Act. But watch what happens and see if you think that the metaphor holds up. I think it at least suggests a way of looking at the two situations. Well, what I promised you is that I would spend most of my time, and I do hope I haven't used all of it, with the question about scientific relationships with the public and the public's trust. First question is, which everybody asks as they see research funding decrease or as they read polls about who the public respects, is the question, don't they love us anymore? Well, I really think they do love us anymore. If you look at what's happened to the prestige status of professions, I may have to ask Dan Yankelovich for help here, but my impression, at least, is that there has been a sort of systemic decrease in public attitudes about a lot of they don't really love the Congress, do they? And the clergy is not in great shape either. The military's up, but almost everybody else is down a little. We can take no comfort in the fact that other professions are down. There's no comfort in saying, you know, it's happening to everyone. But I do think we have to examine some special reasons why science may be in a little public difficulty. And let me mention a couple before going into some more seriously troublesome ones. The first is that now that many professors in universities are in business with their own companies as well as being professors, the question arises when somebody goes on the evening news and speaks of a wonderful discovery, is she speaking of as Harvard or as Stratagene or whatever the name of the company is? That leads, I think, to some doubt. Second source is the deep involvement increasing of science in regulation. Dick gave me some praise I don't really deserve, which is of installing more science into the FDA. But to the extent that science is involved in regulation, and it increasingly is, then it surely is a source of public concern, because often regulation interferes with what people believe are individual rights. And so if they don't like regulation, they're not going to like the science that supports it. Third, in the courtroom, expert witnesses now are called by plaintiffs, called by industry defendants in product liability and tort actions and so forth regularly. And as these are reported in the media, They often get billed as two scientists, apparently equally qualified, although that's often not made clear, some believe this, some believe that. Who in the world is able to choose between those two versions? If they can't get things straight, who needs to listen to them is certainly one possible response. I think there are some more serious problems in the relationship between the public and science, and let me touch on a couple with a little bit of history and then suggest some solutions at the end. There is an old struggle between people who practice science and people who are concerned with national security and wish to guard science from the knowledge of persons who wish to do us harm. That's not a new problem, although it's hugely exacerbated since 9/11. Historically, it involved, in the first place, famously, the University of California and the weapons laboratories that were under the control of the University of California. The Wen Ho Lee case came at exactly the wrong time, in some sense. The University of California's management of the laboratories was sometimes challenged by the security folks on the basis that it wasn't paying enough attention to security. The scientific folks were worried that the security people were constraining research, which they may well have been. It was difficult from my distance to undertake any kind of serious examination of the merits of that, but Dick was surely very close to it and may have a comment afterwards about it. It did lead ultimately to the competitive reallocation of those functions, which the University of California won, fortunately. But nonetheless, it was an example at that time of contests between security issues and science issues. At Stanford, meanwhile, in 1980-81, we were getting some really serious complaints from scientists about a number of issues. Visas for foreign visitors to basic research laboratories. Requirements that foreign nationals be excluded from certain kinds of research projects. Barring foreign nationals from seminars and symposia. Requirements that Stanford faculty who are inviting foreign visitors shadow them as they travel around Silicon Valley and visited Hewlett-Packard and other places of interest. They really hated trotting around after people who they found, you know, likely found not that interesting to keep company with anyway. So how was all this to be solved? We worried about it, and a Stanford alumnus named Dick DeLauer, who had been at TRW, had become Undersecretary for Research and Education, a job actually that Bill Perry also had early. And he had invited me to co-chair something called the DoD Universities Forum that was going to try to do some deal making and understanding building between the two enterprises. And so we started looking at the problem of interference with basic research on the part of government worried about the leakage of secrets under things like the arms control regulations and so forth. So we had urged that somebody consider exempting basic research from that kind of security inspection. And so did a National Academy of Sciences committee chaired by Dale Corson at Cornell. And We had made these representations to people who we thought had the power to do something about them, and the silence was absolutely deafening, and nothing happened. So finally, there was an announcement from the White House a couple of years after these recommendations had come down. Nobody expected anything. We thought maybe somebody else in the Defense Department, like Richard Perle, had gotten to the White House. So the president issued an executive order, and I want to read it. It is the policy of this administration that, to the maximum extent possible, the products of fundamental research remain unrestricted. And it went on to describe how unrestricted it should be and put responsibility on federal agencies to do it. It has a name. The name is National Defense Security Directive 189. And so now we fast forward to 9/11. Is 189 alive? Well, Condi Rice, as National Security Advisor, said it lives in a letter that universities published and distributed as widely as they possibly could. So it's the administration's policy, unquestionably. No ifs, ands, or buts. But there's something called SBU, sensitive but unclassified. Well, it can't exist, but it's everywhere. I mean, this is really a marvelous conundrum in government. It just crops up everywhere, and it, in fact, a series of task forces from universities and from the academies have looked at that problem, discovered that it is way too prevalent. And as a journal editor, I would encounter similar things. You probably don't know of something called the Office of Foreign Assets Control. If your company is not on the waiver list, if your country is not on the waiver list, and only good countries are on the waiver list, evildoers are not on the waiver list. So, if you send something to the bad countries, it's an export and you can't do it. But if you do something here to help a bad country, that's a deemed export. Deemed export means it's not really an export because it happened here, but we're going to deem it one. And the deemed export provision, for example, told me and told other journal editors that if you edit a manuscript, suppose you've got a manuscript done on Cuban rainforests by a group of Cubans and a Canadian team that's been down there. And it comes in, and the language isn't too great. It really needs some work, and we like to help authors and prove that we can improve manuscripts, and so we do. Can't do that. That's a deemed export. I was hugely tempted to create an imaginary manuscript that was full of typos, things that spell check could easily have recognized, and so forth, and publish it with a note at the top that said, according to the Office of Foreign Assets Control, I can't touch this mess, so I thought you'd like to see what we get that we can't deal with. I mean, I'm not quite that dumb and didn't do it. But that was actually a problem for journal editors, a problem for institutions. So fast forwarding to today, you know, it's not a very good situation. I'd like to explore two other quick issues. I would have said a little bit more about the cultural origins of security people and scientists, because they're rather vastly different, and it's no wonder they don't understand each other very well. But that can well be passed over. The second issue that I want to explore has to do with the new contests between evangelical religions and science teaching. I got involved at this in this at the Academy. We published a high school book called Teaching About Evolution and the Nature of Science. It was a very interesting exercise. When we did a press conference on that book, I a reporter popped up and said, "Well, Dr. Kennedy, don't you realize it's doing this with Maxine Singer?" And he said, "Don't you know that half the American people don't believe in evolution?" I said, "Well, you know, we're trying to deal with that." And then somebody else popped up their hand and said, "Do you also know that half the American people do believe in astrology?" And all I could do is express the hope that it's the same half. So I've had a serious look at this literature, because I'm going to do a little bragging here. I've been an expert witness in a case defending the University of California. Go Cardinal! I mean, this is something I was really happy to do, and I had to read a lot of these books. The Bob Jones University text in biology. When my visitors to my office found these books lying on the table, they thought I'd finally lost it, and. But I read them all. You ought to do this, because it's not merely about an alternative system of belief, which it is, but it's also about attempting by really kind of zany metaphors to trash a seriously scientific view. It's very hard for me to believe that a young person who comes out of that kind of classroom can anytime afterwards take science as seriously as their colleagues in, let's say, freshman education someplace else. I think it's a real problem for science, and I think we see it, of course, played out in the stem cell debates, where it's an important influence, and what I think is the wrong side. But we also see some biologists taking an adamantly adverse position to all religion, and I think that's unfortunate. I think the last thing we want in this country is an exacerbated division between two different cultures, the brights and the believers, or whatever people choose to call it. I think this is a problem that can be solved with a little more moderation. I'll say only one word about the stem cell debate and the role of evangelical religious conviction in it, as that conviction translates to politics. The position of the president with respect to the 17 or 78 or only 12 or maybe 6 cell lines that biologists could use was that this is based on some kind of ethical universal. And if you look at various religions, I think you have to come to the conviction that it's not a universal. It's the position of a particular set of religious convictions based on convictions about when life begins. The idea that, you know, there are a lot of people who believe that a blastocyst growing in a petri dish will develop into a little person if we don't pay attention to it. And that doesn't happen. And for years, embryologists have struggled a little bit with the linguistic problem. How do you deal with this? Because people say that when you call a 16 cell or 60 whatever cell blastocyst, you're kidding people because it's really an embryo. But embryologists of all faiths decided a long time ago that you don't call it an embryo until it's implanted in a uterus and begins the morphogenetic movements that ultimately lay down tissue layers and become eventually a replica of one or both or some combination of its parents. So I think the problem with this debate is that a lot of people are trying to figure out ways in which we can create the equivalent of embryonic stem cells to steer around this difficulty. And I think that that is all really an effort that resigns an important element of the separation between church and state. That is, gives into it. Resigns in front of it. And I'm concerned about that, and I have some arguments with my colleagues about it. Finally, I was going to mention something about climate change, but there are so many climate change people here, people who know the issues and so forth, that I think I'm going to skip that one. And I'm passionate about climate change, by the way, and I can't understand why the IPCC consensus about climate change is so difficult for a fair number of people to swallow. But the scientific history of all this has been pursued in your institution by Naomi Oreskes, among others, a historian of science who has looked at the relationship between the kind of denial that occurs in this case and other cases. What I do worry most about with respect to science and the public is another use of security and security considerations, which seems to me to be a real abuse of science. For some years, we have seen security considerations used not to defend disclosures that might present a problem in our national interest, but rather to protect people from knowledge about science that is not consistent with predetermined policies that rest on that science. There's a cart and a horse in this game, and science ought to be the horse, and policy ought to be the cart. And I think we've been in some danger of seeing the cart precede the horse. There's a lot going on here, and I don't want to give you a long list. Jim Hansen, fortunately, although a number of attempts have been made to stifle his views about climate change, is the kind of guy that will rip that will rip a gag off his mouth the minute you try to put it on. And Jim Hansen is talking freely to the public and others, and that's a good thing. It may not be so easy for the U.S. climate scientists who a couple of years ago, government-employed people, were instructed when they went to an international conference not to talk about climate change, but about climate variability instead. The use of language to recast an issue and to recast people's expectations about the conclusion of that issue is so interesting to me that I think it ought. I think some people are making it a serious study, and I look forward to reading it. That problem is, I'm afraid, by no means unique. There's a case of Julia McDonald, an employee of the Department of the Interior, an engineer who supervised a number of biologists who were doing habitat assessments under the Endangered Species Act, to qualify species for inclusion or exclusion from that act. There, the Inspector General of the Department of the Interior found that she had bullied the biologists who were in her unit and changed their findings to suit what upper-level department policies were, and the fact that she had shared information that she had gathered and that her biologists had gathered with others, including lobbyists. She resigned before a scheduled congressional hearing, and the department is still considering some charges against her. Julie Gerberding, the head of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, had testimony that she was bringing before Congress. Of course, it's quite usual for agency heads and the OMB and in OIRA and others to scrutinize testimony that's given in the government's name, the administration's name, to Congress. In this particular case, it went before Jack Marburger, the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. I differ from some of my colleagues in thinking that Jack is a reasonable man caught in a position that's quite difficult for him. He made a few suggestions in the margin when it went down to the Office of Management and Budget. They didn't have time to edit it, so they crossed out 6 pages of the testimony. And when that became public, there was some considerable reservation about process and procedure, and a lot of people considered it just a continuation of a long saga. So if you believe that that's a problem, and I believe that it is a real abuse of science, then the question arises, what in the world can we do about it? And I'm going to take just a moment or two to ponder that. Should science win all conflicts with security? Obviously, no one thinks that. But the case for security ought to be based on realistic threats, and it shouldn't have anything to do with the censorship or shielding of information. What would we do to change the situation? One thing is that we ought to say, well, it's never been quite this bad until now, which I do truly believe. Then the problems will disappear in the next administration. I think it would be a mistake to rely on that. I think we ought to look seriously at the problems we have and set up a set of rules about government appointments and about government policy and behavior with respect to the scientists who work for them or advise them with respect to the protection of their credibility and their scientific candor. The rules needed to support a wise policy in this regard, I think, should include maybe the following. A newly elected president and his administration will necessarily include persons with positions that the elected party is comfortable with. But there are other positions which are so explicitly scientific and whose qualifications are scientific and essentially not political, that those positions ought to be listed. Perhaps a serious academy study ought to be engaged in creating a sort of a purple book equivalent, a violet book maybe, that lists the science appointments that ought to be strictly free of that kind of scrutiny. So that list could be presented perhaps at the time a new administration takes office, and it would encourage the president to appoint a science advisor first so that person's help can be gathered in judging about those appointments rather than too late, as it has been lately. So there's a growing need, I think, for a kind of freedom doctrine for government scientists to protect the sanctity of their reports on science and its separation from political considerations or policy considerations, and that this should not be based on finger-pointing about even the present administration, although God knows I have pointed a finger occasionally on the editorial page of Science, but rather as a protection in the future. It will be very much more acceptable, like most grandfather clauses are politically, and I hope some consideration will be made to doing that. I've enjoyed my day in San Diego tremendously. I thank you all for coming tonight, and I hope you'll have some questions for me. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.